Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It is. Well, today I, in the past, like yesterday, we discussed the Alaya Vijnana, and so I want to talk about the other aspects of consciousness. There's still a lot more to talk about the Alaya Vijnana, but to recap a little bit, the Alaya, of course, is the eighth consciousness, eighth level of consciousness. Now, each, although there are eight consciousnesses, they are, of course, all dependent on the Alaya. All the other seven are dependent on the Alaya. And so we want to talk about manas, which is self-consciousness, called self-consciousness, or it's called actually defiled consciousness, because it's the sense of individuation, which consciousness itself, all the various consciousnesses are consciousnesses of discrimination, of division, and the seventh consciousness, manas, is the real the reason it's defiled is because it is considered false consciousness, in the sense of believing in Atman and Dharmas. So I'm going to read a little bit about manas consciousness, the seventh consciousness. This is from Vasubandhu's 30 stanzas, which actually is almost identical to the 100 dharmas that were in the other book. And the Ching Wei Shir Lun, which is this big, thick book of commentaries on it. This is a kind of overview, which was by Xuan Zang. So the Ching Wei Shir Lun says that this evolving consciousness, manas, manifests itself with the Alaya Vijnana as its basis and support, and takes that consciousness as its object. So the Alaya uses manas uses the Alaya as its basis and support, and because the Alaya is the repository of the seeds and the manifestation vehicle for all dharmas, manas mistakes it for a self. So our it kind of means that when you say, well, who are you? Well, I'm my thoughts, I'm my feelings, am I my emotions? So manas believes this. Manas believes I am my thoughts. I am my. That's just what my thoughts, my feelings, my perceptions, and my consciousness. This is what I am. So this is false belief. Okay. So this evolving consciousness, manas, manifests itself with the Alaya as its basis and supports and takes the consciousness, that consciousness as its object. It has the nature and character of cogitation, thinking, or intellection. In the sacred teachings, this consciousness is given the special name of manas because, in its perpetual practice of intellection, it surpasses the other consciousnesses. In other words, this is the smart consciousness, intelligence. Inasmuch as it perpetually thinks about the ego, Atman, to which it clings, it has close relationship with the four fundamental kleshas. Kleshas are vexing passions, or vexing passions, sources of affliction and delusion. These four are self-delusion, or Atman ignorance, self-belief, self-conceit, and self-love. So these are the major four defilements which we all possess and cling to. Self-delusion means lack of understanding. It is ignorance of the true character of Atman, or the self, and delusion as to the principle that there is no Atman or self, or egoless, or ego. There's actually no real ego. Therefore, it is called self-delusion. Self-belief means adhering to the view that Atman, self, exists, erroneously imagining certain dharmas to be the self, when they are not so. Hence, it is called self-belief. You can say self-belief, or you can say self-belief. Belief in the self. Self-conceit means pride, basing itself on the belief in an Atman. It causes the mind to feel superior and lofty. It is therefore called self-conceit. Self-love means a greedy desire for the self. Because of its belief in the Atman, it develops deep attachments to it. It is therefore called self-love. I'll wait for the image in my consciousness to pass by. So it's like attachment to an illusion, and we have many Greek tragedies based on this. But you know, we say, well, we should love ourselves. You know, one of the four Brahma Viharas, or not Brahma Viharas, but metta practices is extending love to yourself, right? Which is important, but this is different. This is like attaching to a real self. Loving what is an illusion. Seeing your image in the clear lake and falling in love with it. So the words "together with" indicate that self-conceit and self-love accompany self-belief. So if we have self-belief, it's accompanied by self-conceit and self-love. And that self-love accompanies self-conceit. So if we have self-conceit, it's accompanied by self-love. An association which is not admitted by the Sarvastivadins. So, you know, all of the schools, when they address this kind of problem of the self and Atman and Dharma, all have different takes, different ways of thinking about it. And Vasubandhu's understanding has superseded them all. That's why he's the most, that's why his understanding is most prominent. But throughout the commentaries, these other views are expressed. So as to compare and see how which view is really superior or which view is really most correct.
What's the difference between self-delusion and self-belief?
Self-delusion is means lack of understanding. It is ignorance of the true character of the Atman, and delusion as to the principle that there is no Atman. Self-belief means adhering to the view that Atman exists erroneously, imagining certain dharmas to be the self when they are not so. So self-delusion is, just means lack of understanding, whereas self-belief is inherent. You really believe certain dharmas are the self.
More active.
Well, yeah, more specific, whereas the other is more general, maybe. So these four kleshas or defilements, by their constant manifestation, disturb and pollute the innermost mind, or the alaya vijnana. So the way they pollute, I think, is by manifesting or creating polluted seeds that are deposited in the alaya. So the four kleshas, by their constant manifestation, disturb and pollute the innermost mind, or alaya vijnana, and cause the outer, the remaining seven, transforming consciousnesses to be perpetually defiled. Because of this, sentient beings are bound to the cycle of birth and death without being able to liberate themselves from it. Hence they are called vexing passions or kleshas. This is why manas is so dangerous. because it pollutes not only the avaya, but also pollutes the other seven consciousnesses because of its false sense of attachment to itself and to dharmas. This is the, we've located the ego, and it's called the manas. Manas, though, actually has a purpose. Because the alaya, the eighth consciousness, the seed bin, is the support for all the other seven consciousnesses. Manas is a support for manovijnana, which is sense consciousness. So, manas is a conveyor of information from the sense consciousness. Through the senses, convey information to manovijnana, the sixth consciousness, which conveys the information to the alaya and back. So that's, it's like a conveyor of information when it's not perverted, when it's not deluded. So each one of these consciousnesses, when manas actually, they say eliminating manas, but eliminating manas is a little extreme. When manas becomes lets go of attachments, then the whole system works according to reality. When manas is no longer attached to alaya as its self, and realizes the emptiness of dharmas, then it takes its rightful place. It does its job. But the problem is, being deluded, it inflates its own position.
Can you describe its rightful job?
What is what?
Can you describe what its rightful job?
Yeah, its rightful job is to convey information.
You're saying that the information is that it's about me, you know, it's about the self.
The information of the dharmas to the alaya. In other words, it's no longer self-consciousness. When it's purified, it's no longer self-consciousness. It's called wisdom. So I'll get to that. I haven't got there yet. But self-consciousness, seventh or alaya, takes information and construes it according to its delusion, and then sends it on, because it distorts what it receives through its delusion of self-consciousness.
Did you said alaya distorts or manas distorts?
Manas is the distorter.
No.
Alaya is not the distorter.
Oh, you said alaya. Please.
I may have said that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Don't do that.
Thanks. Yeah. Manas. Yeah. Alaya is neither good nor bad, or nor distorted. Alaya is totally honest, without self. Yeah.
I think the interesting question to me in this is, how come this idea of the self is so seductive? You know, the function of manas, which you were going to get to, it has a function which wouldn't necessarily be seduced by this sense of self, but why is it that we're always...
Since beginningless time, that this has been going on.
I noticed that.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Pinocchio.
About what?
Pinocchio. I mean, everybody knows about Pinocchio, right? Has anybody never read Pinocchio? Well, you know, Pinocchio is a wooden boy, but he wanted to be a real boy. And but he was always getting into trouble, you know. And getting into trouble, he was always, you know, his father was scolding, blah, blah. And one day, they came into town, this wagon. And the wagon was drawn by 20 mules, donkeys, actually. And the driver was, you know, dressed like a dandy with a top hat, and you know, and the cart had all these flashing lights and full of toys. And when the cart came into town, this was the cart that the little boys all just loved. And the driver, I can't remember his name, but he would invite all the boys to come to his ranch or to his, whatever it was, you know, to his place. Playland, actually. Come to his playland. So Pinocchio was, gosh, you know, maybe I should do that. And he looked at one of the mules, one of the donkeys, and he said, that donkey looks so familiar. Something familiar about that donkey. He looks just like one of my old friends. Anyway, he decided that he would jump on and go to the playland where everything was free. You know, the kids just had everything they wanted. And so as he was driving along in the cart, there was a mirror, and he looked in the mirror, and or he felt funny. His body felt funny. He said, God, what's going on with my body? And he looked in the mirror, and he could see ears starting to sprout from his head. And then a tail was, looked behind him, there was a tail sprouting from his behind. And he ended up as a mule, as one of the donkeys. And I can't remember what happened after that exactly, but he got redeemed, and eventually he became a boy, I believe. Every time he lied, his nose got like Richard Nixon. So, you know, I got this idea that, you know, what the sutras are saying all the time is that we get tangled up. We get tangled up in our life. We start out untangled. We start out with new goods. And then little by little, we just get tangled up and tangled up. And to get into ball, we just keep going round and round and round in our tangle. And we can't, it's like a web. Life, the world is like a web. You know, when you look at the animal world, it's like dog eat dog. It's a dangerous place for animals. And it's a dangerous place for us. And we get, our world is different than the animal world, but it's somewhat the same. You know, the big animals are looking for the little animals, you know, just eating each other, and the fish are all eating each other. And the human world is emotional, mental entanglements. And through our emotional and mental entanglements, and we create this belief in a self. So there's a kind of, it looks to me like we see the world is like a trial. Some people see the world as a trial. We meet these dharmas, and we get entangled with the dharmas, and then we suffer. And that's what brings us to revolving. So we start looking for a way to untangle ourselves. But the tangle is necessary. It's not like, you know, a mistake. The mistake is not making some effort to relieve ourselves from the tangle. But I think we have to go through the tangle. Everybody has to go through the tangle one way or another and come out untangled. How do you it's like Alexander, when he was in some place and he was given the Gordian knot to untie. This is a knot that nobody could untie, and the king said, well, here, untie the knot. Nobody could undo it. He took out his sword and went. So So in a way, it's like Manjushri. Manjushri has the sword that untangles the Gordian knot.
That's the opening of the Visuddhimagga, also from the sutra, the inner tangle and the outer tangle.
The inner tangle and the outer tangle.
Can untangle this tangle.
That's right. That's also in the Mahayana Sutra, which they might can't remember. Sarangama Sutra. So we got six tangles. Six, yeah.
It sounds as if there's this manas vijñāna, that this ego, that interrupts or kind of plays with the flow of the senses as they're going up to the alaya, as a self-serving thing, and it gets tempted by one thing or another, and then we get tangled up as a result. And then with our practice, you're proposing that this manas becomes not, it becomes transformed, and it allows a flow of information back and forth, and doesn't convolute and tangle us more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that things no longer affect us. The stimulation, the various senses and all that are still absorbing information. But how would you describe, say, a practitioner who lets this information go through, but there's still a self, there's still this person that is it simply, I recognize you, this is where I will get tangled if I attach to this temptation. Mm-hmm. There's still a self, and the information is still flowing up and flowing back down. Right. It's not like there's this miraculous, seamless, that's like a fantasy, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem of the self, you know, if you say no self, it doesn't mean that there's nothing there. You know, if you say dharmas are without self, doesn't mean that they're not there. So it simply means they have no inherent self. And so our self-belief we are an assembly of dharmas, but there's no self in the dharmas, right? No inherent self in the dharmas, but there is a everything works. So we call this, we say, well, this is myself, but it's a self, it's not a self. If you only see it one side or the other, if you only see that, understand that no self doesn't mean that there's not a self. It means that the self that we that acts is not a self, but that it's neither self nor not self. That's the middle way. It's neither a self nor not a self. But we say no self in order to understand that it's that the self is not a self.
And does that self and not a self suffer?
Still, well, okay.
Is it still subject to suffering?
Let's see what the sutra says.
So we have this phrase, you know, the sum is greater. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and so we understand the self as interdependent upon all these factors, but the self is a whole that's still some way greater than the sum of the parts.
Well,
Jesus.
Let's see. So the question is raised, if a real Atman does not exist, how can memory, perception of objects, etc. be explained? Okay, if there's no self, how can all this be explained? In reply to this, the Master expresses the view that each sentient being has a fundamental consciousness, which is Alaya Vijnana, which evolves in a homogeneous and continuous series and carries within it the seeds or germs, bijas, of all dharmas. This fundamental consciousness and the dharmas act as reciprocal causes on one another. And because the perfuming energy, vasana, of the dharmas imprints its essence permanently on the alaya vijnana in the form of seeds or bijas, memory, cognition, etc., are brought into manifestation. The bijas manifesting themselves as actual dharmas, which in turn produce bijas in the alaya. So, in other words, seed sprout, due to various causes, dharmas appear, and when the dharmas appear, they are a cause for the new seeds. So there's this continuation continually. So further questions are raised. If there is no real Atman, by whom is a deed accomplished? By whom are the fruits of deeds reaped? In reply, the Master points out the truth that by virtue of the force of causes and conditions, the mind and its activities of each sentient being evolve in a continuous, uninterrupted series, resulting in the accomplishment of acts and the reaping of their fruits. So it's simply dharmas rolling on. There's a in the Trimsika, he says that the alaya is like a rushing torrent which is has continued from beginning of this time to endless end. So it's something the alaya is continuously producing dharmas, which are continually producing seeds, which are continuously producing dharmas, which are continuously producing seeds, which are continuously producing dharmas. So it's like just like a rolling ball that is continually redoing itself. What is that? Continuous, perpetual motion machine. The alaya is like a perpetual motion machine which continues, which drives itself because of its momentum. So the alaya vijnana is momentum, basically. And when we look at our life, we see that our life is nothing but momentum, which means from moment to moment. Continuous moment to moment, yes.
I have a question about vow.
Vow?
About life of vow.
Mm.
In the stream, the the tumultuous stream of Elia.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts arise, impressions arise, memories, and perhaps an idea occurs to this impermanent self, this totally interconnected self, of an outcome, desired outcome.
Yes.
So, given that it all exists
mm-hmm.
in the Elia.
Well, it exists. Yeah, okay.
Potential.
Yes.
So, I guess I have a question about vow and skillful means in the face of all this.
Uh-huh. So, vow practice is to... the vow practice is to raise yourself out of samsara and practice the way of liberation.
And the bodhisattva vow.
Yeah. And the bodhisattva vow is to save all beings before you go for your own liberation. So bodhisattva doesn't make that split between samsara and nirvana. That's why you can practice in the world. That's why we practice in the world. Otherwise, we'd just be stuck in a monastery, which is not a bad place to be stuck, but it's good. Practicing in a monastery is very good. And that's where you have your education. But the result should be that you leave and go back into the world.
Sojin, earlier you mentioned the practice of metta.
Metta, yeah.
What is the difference? Can you clarify the difference between that and the delusional self-love of manas?
No, metta is loving kindness to others. But there is a metta practice in which you express metta to yourself so that you can express it to others. The formula is you express love for yourself, wash love, and then express that to someone who you don't know, express it to someone who you do know, express it to someone that it may be your enemy or someone who you have ill feelings about, and then express it to the world and so forth. So it starts from you, right? That's why. But it's not the self-love of ego. It's simply pure love is not self-centered. This is a whole, study of what is love. Right? So basically metta, the four Brahma Viharas actually are the basis of Buddhist way Buddhists express love. But so although you express love for the universe, you have to include yourself, which is not your ego but your true self. So there's ego self and true self. So when ego is absorbed, so to speak, when there is realization of no ego, then the whole universe is yourself. This is the understanding. Basic understanding
Also, loving kindness is not exactly the same thing as other kinds of loving.
It's
gentle, kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish you well.
It's totally dissociated from the self-love that's expressed here. So, but self-love has two dimensions. One is for your personal self, and the other is for your true self, which is the universe. So, in that sense, it's just your mode. It's not directed at anything in particular. It's just, since it's your mode, it's just expressed wherever you are to whatever you meet.
So, two thoughts came up for me a few minutes ago while you were speaking. The first thought that came up, as you were talking about this self, which is a no-self, and energy, the image that came up for me is like dominoes falling. Like one domino hits the next, which mm-hmm. is the next. And if you look at it, you see the energy going around the room as, you know, but, you know, what is it or where is it? You know, it's more like energy moving. That was the first kind of image that came up for me.
Yeah, it's energy movement. Yeah, definitely. How you allow the energy to move without distorting it or not understanding it. Of course, we don't understand ultimately, but but we can act even though we don't understand. You know, we can sit zazen even though we don't understand it. That's the virtue of practice, is that we can come in without knowing anything at all about Buddhism and sit in zazen, you know.
Something else that occurred to me, I was thinking, so then, you know, what is the self? Which is a question that I've tried to ask myself for years now. It just occurred to me to ask the question, easier to understand question, what is the Berkeley Zen Center? I mean, or what is IBM? I mean, so what is it? No, seriously.
Yes.
I mean, is it you? Is it this building? Is it a community? I mean, whatever aspect you look at, you say, well, yeah, there's a community here. Yeah, there are pillars here. But is that, yeah, there's an abbot.
That's a very interesting question. That in the Hawaiian understanding, mm-hmm. you look at a building and you say, well, what's the building? Is it the door? Is it the frame? Is it the foundation? Is it the high beam, or, you know, the pillars, or whatever? What is it? So, and Coates' question, is it bigger than the sum of its parts? Right? But when you look at it, you say, well, this is the building. But if you take any particular point, like the foundation is the whole building. The roof is the whole building. If you take off the roof, you don't have a building. If you take away the foundation, you don't have a building. So all the parts are the building, but each part is the whole building. That's you, yourself, or the Berkeley Zendo, completely. I'm the Berkeley Zendo completely. And every one of us is totally the Berkeley Zendo. That's why when I go to Tassajara, and I talk to the students, the first talk I give when I lead the practice period is, each one of us is totally equal. The abbot has a position, general labor has a position, but if you are general labor, there's a hierarchy of positions, but at the same time everyone is equal. So if you are as general labor, are you doing your position totally, and your whole body mind is totally in that position, that makes the whole thing work. And you are driving the practice. Just in the same way that the abbot is driving the practice. So each part is as important as every other part. This is the true meaning of hierarchy. And when I talked about the tree and the roots going into the ground yesterday, sucking up the nutrients. The senses are like sucking up the nutrients. and the crown, maybe the crown of the tree is like the distributor called mind consciousness. And then, of course, manas is true. It's nothing, I'm a tree, but it's it's distributing all that juice up to the branches and leaves, which are like the Elia. And so the whole thing is circulating beautifully, and the whole tree is blooming, and Vairochana is up there in the sky, raining down the sun. So each part is important. Every single part is doing it. Is without all the parts, it doesn't work. So each part is equal, no matter what it is. That's why it's just as great to wash the dishes as it is to give a talk. Although I don't wash the dishes very often, but I do cook.
getting back a little bit to this this metaphor of Alaya Vijnana being this torrential flow, dharma's rolling along,
mm-hmm.
seeds sprouting and mm-hmm. growing trees and trees growing more seeds and back to back and all. But repeating this endlessly, I wonder if this is like a really ancient metaphor before the concept of evolution.
Mm. Oh, yes.
And uniqueness.
Evolution is what it's called. Evolving consciousness.
Yeah, so there's something about evolution that brings forth new forms or unique forms. And it's not so much the cyclical model.
Oh, I see. Well, that's an interesting concept. Bringing forth new forms all the time. But it's like each dharma that is produced only lasts for a moment. Everything produced is momentary. That's why it has no self. And the way things continue is through a series. So this moment gives way to this moment, which gives way to this moment, which gives way to this moment. So this entity gives way to this entity, gives way to this entity, moment by moment. So each one of us is totally evolving all the time, but we don't see it. We say, he's a baby, and then he gets middle age, or youth, middle age, but 5 minutes of time is evolutionary. There's so much happening in that 5 minutes that we don't necessarily pay attention to, unless we're caught in zazen by the pain in our legs, and all we can do is breathe. Mm-hmm. And then we're actually living kasana to kasana, moment to moment. But we don't usually realize the momentous dynamic activity that's happening all the time called change.
Even though there's this vast background of entanglements and evolving consciousness, really there's only this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's really just this. So how does that relate to all my ancient tangled karma? It's just this.
Well, all the ancient tangled karma is what brought us to all this. It's brought us to this moment.
But we can only deal with this. But
that's right. So the past, which doesn't really exist, but the past present, and then the present present, and the future present, which is just an idea. So, and the past present is a memory, but the present is the sum of all the conditions from inconceivable time. What we are right at this moment is the sum of all the karmic conditions, the fruit of karma in a very broad sense. Like, how did I get here? So we are on the forefront of the evolution of human race, right? But each one of us is individual, and we each have a history, long history of evolution to where we are now. But so we're, you know, this is our problem. So Buddha says, not like the guy with the arrow, you know, he gets shot with the arrow and he says, well, how'd that happen, you know, and who shot that and blah, blah, blah. And Buddha says, just take it out. You know, I don't know how it all happened, you know, this is what I have to work with. This is what I got. This is the ball of wax I got. Now I have to work with it. So we shouldn't complain about our place in the world, you know. Somehow it happened. Yeah.
But I think that the problem, and I think the whole study that we've been doing, the problem to me is that we feel that the thing that we perceive as our past is defining what's going to be our future.
That's right.
We believe in the solidity of it rather than in the transparency or the transformative possibility of it. So, yeah, we have this moment, but we think, you know, whether we were conscious of it or not, that this moment is conditioned by what happened in the past, but we think that determines what's going to happen in the next moment, and that's exactly the problem.
Well, it does, except that we have the ability to change the trajectory of
right.
our karma.
And that's the Buddhist, notion of karma rather than, say, Brahmanic.
Right. So we're not stuck in our karma unless we don't do anything about it. If we don't do anything about it, then we can see our destiny. But if going in the same direction, you know, we have the ability to change, even though it may be hard, difficult, you know, but it's possible, and we can change our karma. And this is what the vow means. Your vow means that your vow gives you the ability to change your karma, because you're living by karma, by vow instead of by karma. That's the difference. Living by vow means you're no longer stuck living by karma.
So I think it also goes back to Ross's question in part about what is the self when it's not defiled. And it seems to me that self is wants nothing for itself. It's unselfish.
Well, it's not self-centered. It's not
self-centered.
It's not, we're not centered around that self.
It's not looking for anything. It's just being present and responding to. So you can still be the kind of person you are, but you're not attached because you don't need anything to verify yourself. Your self-doubts disappear and your self-needs become just what they are.
Right. So it's characterized by the phrase, the old man who has nothing more to do.
So how this skill of rising above samsara, how would you say that relates to this study of the nine consciousnesses and the five wisdoms?
It's understanding the self and what is not the self. If you have an understanding of what is and what is not a self, then it helps you to understand who you are.
So if there's the ability to be able to identify them as they arise, that's the skill, really. This rising above.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so hopefully, you know, we don't fall into traps and snares, as Dogen says. Traps and snares will not reach it. you know, it's important to have an intellectual understanding of things, as well as a practice. So we have to do things with reason. And over, Vasubandhu says, the way we understand this is through the study of the scriptures and by reason. Not just believing in the scriptures, using the scriptures for our understanding, but also observing them with reason, so that we don't just take something for granted, but we reason with what's said. it's good to have knowledge. Knowledge is important, but if we only rely on knowledge, that's not enough. If we only rely on Zazen, that's not enough. Even though Dogen says, just Zazen, but he had a lot of knowledge. So I think, you know, we have to be careful when we study something. You say, well, what use is that? You know, it's no use. You just study it. And then 10 years later you see, oh, I understand why I studied that now. But if you're looking for something to study that's going to help you right now, that may not be the case. So, understanding by study, the study goes in and gets digested. And over time, the digestion works, and then, oh, now I understand. It's the way it works. So we may think that studying is useless in some ways or some time, but it matures. I studied this years and years ago, but it was really difficult. And then over periods of time, it becomes more and more evident. I understand it better and better all the time, and keeps making more sense to me. I don't think I could have done this years ago. Well, I want to, I don't know what time we're supposed to start, pretty soon, huh? I want to read you something from Koshananda, who, I think Alan met him, right? In Thailand, a monk.
Actually, I have a very nice picture of you and Koshananda walking together.
Oh, that's right.
That's good.
Right, that's right. With his red hat. So he's talking about eating time. He says, what is life? Life is eating and drinking through all of our senses. So eating and drinking through all of, that's what happens, that's what we do, right? We're constantly eating. These are the roots. And life is keeping from being eaten. What eats us? Time. What is time? Time is living in the past or living in the future, feeding on the emotions. Beings who can say that they have been mentally healthy for even 1 minute are rare in the world. Most of us suffer from clinging to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, and from hunger and thirst. Most living beings have to eat and drink every second through their eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, and nerves. We eat 24 hours a day without stopping. We crave food for the body, food for feeling, food for volitional action, and food for rebirth. We are what we eat. We are the world, and we eat the world. I've often talked about it as like an earthworm. Just big mouth and body. And plowing the ground, The Buddha cried when he saw the endless cycle of suffering. The fly eats the flower, the frog eats the fly, the snake eats the frog, the bird eats the snake, the tiger eats the bird, The hunter kills the tiger. The tiger's body becomes swollen. Flies come and eat the tiger's corpse. The flies lay eggs in the corpse. The eggs become more flies. The flies eat the flowers, and the frogs eat the flies. And so the Buddha said, I teach only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering, eating, and feeling are exactly the same. Feeling eats everything. Feeling has six mouths. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. These are all dharmas, right? The first mouth eats forms through the eye, form dharmas. The second mouth eats sounds, sound dharmas. The third mouth eats smells, smell dharmas. Those are my comments. The fourth mouth eats tastes, taste dharmas. The fifth mouth eats physical contact, and the last mouth eats ideas, that is feeling. Time is also an eater. In traditional Cambodian stories, there is often a giant with many mouths who eats everything. This giant is time. If you eat time, you gain nirvana. When you eat time by living in the moment, when you have just in this moment, when you live just in this moment, time cannot eat you. Everything is causational. There is no you, only causes and conditions. Therefore, you cannot hear or see. When sound and ear come together, there is hearing. When form and eye meet, there is seeing. When eye, form, and consciousness meet, those three, there is eye contact. Eye contact conditions feeling. Feeling conditions perception. Perception conditions thinking. And thinking is I, me, mine, manas. The painful misconception that I see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. This is manas that thinks this. Feeling uses the eye to eat shapes. If a shape is beautiful, a pleasant feeling enters the eye. If a shape is not beautiful, it brings an unpleasant feeling. If we are not attentive to a shape, a neutral feeling comes. These are the three perceptions, the three feelings, basic feelings. The ear is the same. Sweet sounds bring pleasant feelings. Harsh sounds bring unpleasant feelings. And inattention brings neutral feelings. Again, you may think, I am seeing, I am hearing, I am seeing, feeling. But it is not you. It is only contact. The meaning of the I, form, the eye consciousness. It is only the Dharma. A man once asked the Buddha, who feels? The Buddha answered, this is not a real question. No one feels. Feeling feels. There is no I, my, or me. There is only the Dharma. All kinds of feelings are suffering, filled with vanity, filled with I am. Vanity, you know, we have various understandings of what vanity means, but basically, vanity means believing in something that doesn't exist. If we can penetrate the nature of sensations, we can realize the pure happiness of nirvana. Feelings and sensations cause us to suffer because we fail to realize that they are impermanent. The Buddha asked, how can feeling be permanent if it depends upon the body, which is impermanent? When we do not control our feelings, we are controlled by them. If we live in the moment, we can see things just as they are. Doing so, we can put an end to all desire, break our bondage, and realize peace. To understand pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, we have to put the four foundations of mindfulness into practice. Mindfulness can transform pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings into wisdom. The world is created by the mind. if we can control feeling, then we can control the mind. The world is created by the mind. This is exactly what this is saying. If we can control the mind, then we can rule the world. And as Sukhyoshi says, you can be the boss if you can control the mind. Good luck and bad luck. This is incidental, but you'll love it. You've heard it before. Opposites are endless. Good and bad, day and night, right and wrong, mine and yours, praising and blaming, all are opposites and all are endless. Opposites produce each other. Day becomes night, and death becomes rebirth. The egg becomes the hen, and the hen makes the egg. It's just this way. Good luck and bad luck are an endless cycle. There was once a farmer who lost his mare. When the mare disappeared, the people of the village said, "Bad luck." But when the mare came home the very next day, followed by a good strong horse, the people of the village said, "Good luck." Yesterday they thought, "Bad luck." Today they think, "Good luck." Yesterday they said, "Loss." But today they say, "Gain." Which is true. Gain and loss are opposites. When the farmer's son rode the beautiful horse, he fell and broke his leg. Then all the people said, "Bad luck." War came, and all the strong men were drafted. Many men fought and died in the battlefield. Because the farmer's son had broken his leg, he could not go to war. Was this loss or gain? Good luck or bad luck? Who knows? I think it's probably done.
Sergeant, if you want. The schedule says 12 more minutes.
Okay, good. Well, I have a present for you.
Chocolate?
What? We want to know if it's chocolate.
Kind of. Kind of. Let's see. Yeah.
Hmm? So I think passed out.
Yeah, passed out. I'm passing out. Just enough?
Just enough.
So, what does this suggest to you?
Emptiness at the center of everything.
Who said that? What'd you say?
Emptiness at the center of everything.
Emptiness at the center. Yeah. It's like the mudra, right? They're creating this collective mudra.
It's very interesting culturally, though, because in Asia,
you're not supposed to put it.
Extremely rude. But that's culture. That's just.
Well, it's extremely rude for you to put your feet facing somebody else, right? But here, everybody's doing the same thing, so there's nobody else. It's totally equal. It's real equality. And also, differentiation. because each one of those little boys is individual.
It's got a lot of soul.
Back in the 50s.
And they're African. I'm not African American. Anyway, Africans.
Back in the 50s, I knew this musician. He's a kind of bum, but he was a musician. You got a better soul than a shoe soul. He said, all the time.
It's a little interesting in the explanation of the game.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all equal in this. There's a winner.
There's a winner,
the one who keeps on coming up with the most.
Well, each one, they have to name something that's circular. Mm-hmm. And the one who... And whoever can't name something circular has to drop out. So that's the end.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a good mnemonic device to instill that concept in the children.
Well, yeah. It's like circular is really an important form. The world is both... What is the shape of the world? When you walk out the door, it's flat. If you walk across the plains of the Midwest... I remember when my son Daniel rode his bike across the country. When he got to the middle of the country, it was totally flat. And he said, I could ride all day, and it feels like he's just staying in the same place. But actually, the world is round. The world of fish is water. So, but everything is really circular, no matter how straight it is. Didn't Einstein say that space has a curvature? So, revolution. Everything is a round shape, even though, you know, of course it's made of other shapes as well, but fundamentally shapes are round. The head is round, the finger is round, the moon is round, the spheres are round, the planets are round. And what makes things round anyway? Anything, I think anything that lasts gets rounded off. Even money. We round it off to the nearest
trillion.
According to this game of Sami, the circle of love, apparently the final player is the one who has continually successfully stated an expression of round.
Yeah, that's right.
Apparently, that is valuable for a long life and a prosperous life. So we should cultivate our circular thinking.
Oh, I think that's right. So, you know, in Buddhism, life is circular. So, Buddhists don't think of life as a plane, but as a circle. And that's why the idea of rebirth is prominent in both Hindu and all Indian philosophy, but in Buddhism, and it gets mixed up with reincarnation, but I think reincarnation is a little too much, but rebirth is circularity. What goes around comes around, and we can see it in nature. You know, nature is circular. Like the tree grows up, and then it drops its fruit, and the fruit grows up, and creates more trees, and there's that circularity of life in nature. Every plant is reproducing itself in a circular way. So, and we don't understand human circularity very well. It's not investigated so much in science. that I know of. But maybe it is.
The new plant is circular, but it's also not the same plant. It's never exactly.
That's right. It's never exactly the same plant. That's why rebirth is different than reincarnation. Reincarnation implies the same plant, but rebirth doesn't mean that the same plant appears, but the action influence is generated in such a way that that energy is circular, not the person. Yeah, we changed our time. I usually think of service as 10 to 12, but here 12:20, right?
So service day is 12:10.
Oh, 12:10, okay. So it's time to stop, right?
Close enough.
Okay, so this afternoon, I want to talk about consciousness as wisdom. The transformation of consciousness into wisdom. And we can leave this here for this afternoon.